I sincerely believe you think you didn't kill Ruth Fryer. The evidence says you did. You mean you think I blacked it out? It's been known to happen. The human mind plays amazing tricks. Or am I doing the wrong thing in giving you a line of legal defense? I guess anything's possible. The thing is, Mr. Fletcher, what I'm saying is, you have to keep an open mind to the evidence. Even you. You might start to begin to believe the evidence. You see, we have to believe the evidence. There's a lot of evidence. I shouldn't be doing this on the phone. But there's this other body. I understand. I suppose we could work a thing whereby the court appoints a psychiatrist for you. Not yet, Flynn. Do you agree this interpretation of the crime and its solution is a possibility? Yes, of course. Good lad. But it didn't happen. I'm sure you don't think so. I know so. That, too. Well, that's my best guess at the moment. Got to get back to my chubby city council person. Inspector? Yes? I'm about to go to the Ritz-Carlton. Yes? Just warning you, you'd better have your men keep a pretty sharp eye on the side door this time. They will, Mr. Fletcher. They will. Chapter 15. Fletch walked the 18-20 miles to the Ritz-Carlton, which was around a corner and up a few blocks. He hung around the lobby, looking at the books on the newsstand until his watch said 6:35. Then he went into the bar. Countess Sylvia de Grassi was receiving considerable attention from the waiters. Her drink was finished, but one was dusting the clean table, another was bringing her a fresh plate of olive hors d'oeuvres, a third was standing by, admiring her with big eyes. Sylvia, near 40, had brightly tousled bleached hair, magnificent facial features, smooth skin, and apparently the deepest cleavage ever spotted in Boston. Her dress was cut not to cover her breasts, but to suggest the considerable structural support needed. Clearly, there was nothing holding them down. They preceded her like an offering. Ah, Sylvia, nice trip? He kissed her cheek as a socially acceptable alternative. Sorry to be a little late. All three waiters held his chair. Mrs. Sawyer got her eyelashes caught in the freezer door. What's this Mrs. Sawyer freezer door? Sylvia's big brown eyes were puckered with impatient suspicion. Just the best excuse I've heard all day. Now, Flesh, I'm not going to have any of your double talk in English. I want the truth. Absolutely. What are you drinking? Campari and soda. Still watching your figure, huh? Might as well. Everyone else is. He said to all the waiters, as he could get the eye of none of them, a Campari and soda and a bath towel. You don't have a bath towel? Then I'll just have a chivas and water. Now, Sylvia, you were saying you were about to tell the truth. Why are you in Boston?
I come to Boston to stop you. You and Angela, I know you conspire against me. You plan to rob my paintings.
Nonsense, dear lady. What makes you think a thing like that?
Because in Angela's room I found your notes, your address, 152 Bacon Street, Boston, your telephone number, also a list of the paintings.
I see. From that you reasonably concluded I came to Boston to find the paintings.
I knowed you did.
And you followed me.
I come ahead of you. I fly Rome, New York, then Boston. I wanted to be waiting when you got off the airplane in Boston. I wanted you to run right into me.
What fun. What held you up?
I missed the connection in New York.
You mean you were here in Boston on Tuesday?
I was. 5 o'clock I arrived Boston.
My, my. And all that time I thought I knew no one in Boston. What did you do then?
I came here to the hotel. I called you. No answer.
I went out to dinner.
I called you next day, yesterday, leave a message. You never called back.
Okay, so you killed Ruth Fryer.
Why'd you say I killed no one?
She retracted her supercarriage while the waiter served her a drink.
What's this talk of kill?
Fletch ignored the drink in front of him. Sylvia, I don't have the paintings. I have never seen the paintings. I don't know where the paintings are. I'm not even sure I've got the story about the paintings straight.
Then why are you in Boston with a list of the paintings? Tell me that.
I'm in Boston to do research on a book about an American painter named Edgar Arthur Tharpe, Jr. I brought a list of the mythical Degrassi paintings with me just in case I ran across any reference to them. Boston's a center of culture.
How do the Americans say it? Bullshit, Flash. You are engaged to marry my daughter Angela. The day after her father's funeral, you jump on a plane with the list of the missing paintings in your pocket and come to Boston, U.S. America. What else do you think?
Stepdaughter. Angela is your stepdaughter.
I know. She is not mine. She plans to rob me.
Has Menti's will been read?
No. Bullshit lawyers will not read it. They say too much confusion. Police say this matter settled. Go away, Countess. Cry. Bullshit lawyers say this matter not settled. So Countess go away and cry some more. All this time, Angela, Jew, rob me.
Angela's mentioned the paintings. Menti mentioned the paintings. You talk about the paintings. I've never seen the paintings. I don't even know they ever existed.
They exist. I've seen them. They are my paintings now that Menti is dead. Poor Menti. They are what I have in the world. He left them to me.
You don't know that. The will hasn't been read. They're the Degrassi paintings. He might have left them to his daughter, who is a Degrassi. He might have left them to both of you. Do you know what Italian estate laws are concerning such matters? They might not even be mentioned in the will. They've been gone a long time. He might have left them all to a museum in Livorno or Rome.
Nonsense! Menti would never do that to me. Menti loved me. It was his great sadness that we had the paintings no more. He knew how I loved those paintings.
I'm sure you did. So what makes you think the paintings are in Boston?
Because you come here. The day after the funeral, you and Angela have your heads together. Angela wants those paintings. She's going to rob me.
Okay, Sylvia, I give up. Tell me about the paintings.
The Degrassi collection. 19 paintings. Some Menti had from his parents, others he collected himself, before World War II.
And I suspect during and after World War II.
Before, during, after World War II.
He was an Italian officer during the war?
He did nothing about the war. The Degrassis turned their palace Livorno into a hospital.
Palace? Big old house.
They took care of Italian soldiers, citizens, German soldiers, American soldiers, British soldiers, everybody's soldiers. Menti told me. He spent his fortune. He hired doctors, nurses.
And picked up a few paintings.
He had the paintings. Them he did not sell. Even years after the war. Angela was born, he sold his land bit by bit, the Degrassi land, but never sold a painting. You know what the paintings are, you have the list.
Yeah, from what I've been able to find out so far, they've never been recorded, anywhere. No one knows they exist.
Because they have always been in a private collection, the Degrassi collection, see? You are looking for them.
Fletch said, I made an inquiry.
You son of a bitch, you are looking for them, you lied to me.
Andy gave me the list. I said I would make an inquiry. I've asked one dealer about one painting. Please don't call me a son of a bitch anymore. I'm sensitive.
Joe and Angela are not going to rob me of my paintings.
You've made that point pretty well, too. You're accusing me of robbery. Go on with the story. When were the paintings stolen?
2 years ago. Stolen overnight. Every one of them.
From the house in Livorno?
James.
Weren't the servants there?
Ah, they're no good. Very old, very sleepy, deaf and blind. Ria and Pep. Menti had great loyalty for them. Last two Degrassi servants. I told him, they stupid old fools. Never he should leave such a fortune in paintings to their charge.
They heard nothing and saw nothing?
Flesh, they didn't even realize they were gone until we came back to the house and said, where are the paintings? They were so used to them. They had seen them all their lives. They didn't even recognize when they were gone. All the time we were away, they never even went in front of the house.
And the paintings weren't insured?
Never. Stupid old Italian counts do not insure things they've always had, always been used to.
Menti was a stupid old Italian count, eh?
About insurance, he was as bad as the rest of them. As bad as the Catholic Church.
He probably couldn't afford the premiums.
He couldn't afford the premiums. Then whoosh, one day they were gone.
The police did not care so much, just some paintings, they said. There was no big insurance company making them find the paintings and kill the people who stole them.
You weren't in Livorno when the paintings were stolen?
Menti and I were in our honeymoon, in Austria.
That's not far. Fletch tried one of the olives. So, where are the paintings, Sylvia? What you mean, where are the paintings, Sylvia?
I think you stole them yourself. Is that what you don't want me to find out? Is that why you're here?
Stole them myself?
Sure. In your mid-30s, you married a 67-year-old Italian count with a palace in Livorno and an apartment in Rome. You're his third wife. He's your second husband. Your first husband was Brazilian?
French.
Her face vacillated between studied amusement and murderous rage. You have, let's say, international connections. You marry the old boy. You go on your honeymoon. You discover he's broke, or he has very little money, nothing like the fortune you thought he had. You realize his whole fortune is in these paintings. He's 30 years older than you. You think he might leave the paintings to his daughter, to a museum. After all, you told him you married him for love, right? So you arranged to have the paintings stolen. You stashed them away. Did you even arrange to have Menti kidnapped and murdered? Now you're scared to death I'm going to catch you. The amusement in her face was agonized. She said, I hate you. Because I'm right. I loved Menti. I would do nothing to harm him. I did not steal the paintings. But you too left Rome the day after the funeral. To catch you. It's one thing for the prospective son-in-law of the deceased to leave town the day after the funeral. It's something else for the grieving widow to skip. If I killed anyone, I would kill you. Which brings up another question, Sylvia. Did you come to my apartment Tuesday night? Was the door opened by a naked young lady who said she was waiting for Bart Connors? Not being able to make sense out of her, did you hit her with a whiskey bottle?
I not make sense out of you.
Of course not.
You say your apartment is 20 miles away. That's what you said.
It's just around the corner, Sylvia, and you know it.
I don't know what you're talking about, killing a girl. First you say I killed Minty, then you say I killed some girl. You're crazy in the head.
I've already admitted that possibility today.
Who is this man you talk to about my paintings?
I have to have a few secrets of my own. Fletch stood and neatly put his chair back under the table. Thanks for the drink, Sylvia.
You're not paying?
You invited me. It's a whole new world, babe. You pay. Chapter 16. I guess it's a pretty good job, Fletch said. I can't read the shit through the paint. It's a nice job if you like hearses, the manager said. What will a black truck do for your plumbing business? I don't know, Fletch said. Might improve it. Neighbors will think you're carrying out a body. Friday morning was cool and cloudy again. The manager said, did you get down to the registry? Fletch said, I brought cash for you. I'll get the bill. Fletch paid him off and took the keys to his black panel truck. Okay, fella, the manager said, you get stopped in that truck and the registration don't match. Don't say where you got it painted. I'll get to the registry tomorrow, Fletch said, Saturday. When he was getting into the truck, the manager said, don't you suppose you got a spare minute? Why? What's the matter? Leak in the men's room. No thanks, said Fletch. Don't need to. Chapter 17. Will you tell Mr. Saunders that Mr. Ralph Locke is in the lobby waiting to see him? The smile of the woman at the reception desk was a widow's smile. In her 50s, she had learned to smile again after a funeral, after someone had given her a job, a new but lesser life. Fletch guessed she was the widow of a journalist, perhaps one of those later names inscribed in a long plaque on the lobby wall, starting with 1898 and dribbling through years of war, collisions with fire trucks, and accidents with demon rum. A copy boy will be right down to get you, she smiled. In mid-afternoon, Fletch had gone down to the Ford Ghia parked at the curb. There were 6 parking tickets under the windshield wipers. Knowing the 2 men in the car across the street were plainclothesmen assigned to watch him, he tore the 6 parking tickets up and dropped the pieces in the street. They did not arrest him for destruction of public records, contempt, or littering. So he led them to the Boston Daily Star building. It was a wet gray stone building in the bowels of the city. The narrow streets around it were clogged with Star delivery trucks. Fletch found 2 places to park. He drove the Ghia into one and waved the policeman into the other. A copy boy led them through the huge, smelly old city room. Jack Saunders was waiting for him near the copy desk. Fletch said, I see the publisher has paid off the mortgage. Shaking hands, Jack looked around the large yellow room. 100 years of nicotine had attached itself to the wall, ceiling, and floor. I think he's almost got it paid off, another few payments.
In the morgue, Jack said to the young help behind the counter, "Randy, this is Ralph Locke, Chicago Post, here working on a story." "I know your byline, Mr. Locke," the kid said. "Ah, shit," said Fletch. Jack laughed. "Show him around, will you, Randy?" Fletch knew the alphabet. He also knew left from right. Very shortly, he got rid of the young hypocrite. First, the regional who's who. An item on page 208 read, "Connors, Bartholomew, lawyer. Born Cambridge, Massachusetts, February 7th, 1936. Son of Ralph and Lillian Day Connors. B.A. Dartmouth, 1958, Harvard Law, 1961. Married Lucy Oriel Hislop, June 6, 1963. Tullen O'Brien and Corbett, 1962 to present. Partner, 1971. Harvard Club, Boston. Harvard Club, New York. Boylston Club. Trustee, Institute of Modern Art. Director, Child's Hospital. Control Systems, Incorporated. Warder Rand, Incorporated. Medical Implements, Incorporated. Home, 152 Beacon Street, Boston. Office, 32 State Street, Boston." An item on page 506 read, "Haran, Ronald Rizom, educator, author, art dealer. Born April 10, 1919, Burlington, Vermont. Son, Charles N. and Beatrice Lansom Haran. B.A. Yale, 1940, U.S. Navy, 1940-45, commander. M.A. Cambridge, 1947. Ph.D. Harvard, 1949. Married Grace Galkis, October 12, 1948, died 1953. Harvard faculty, 1948 to present. Assistant professor, Department of Fine Arts, 1954 to present. Contributing editor, Objects, 1961-65. Contributing editor, Art Standards International, 1955 to present. Author, Themes and Images, September Press, 1952. Techniques in Object Authentication, September Press, 1959. Director, Haran Gallery, 1953 to present. Lecturer, Cambridge, 1966. Athenaeum, St. Paul's Society, Bosley Club. Advisor, Carcass Museum, 1968 to present. Home, 60 Newbury Street, Boston. Office, Haran Gallery, 60 Newbury Street, Boston. There was no item in Who's Who for Inspector Francis Xavier Flynn. There was little in the newspaper clipping files directly concerning either Connors or Haran. Connors was represented by a single clipping. Once he had issued to the press and public the recent tax statements of a then gubernatorial candidate, a client and Harvard Law School classmate who did not win. The story referred to Connors as senior partner of the State Street law firm Tullen O'Brien and Corbett and son of former U.S. Ambassador to Australia, Ralph Connors. Connors's photograph showed a fair-sized, athletic-looking man. The file on Ambassador Ralph Connors apparently had been cleaned out, except for the obituary. Until becoming ambassador, he had been chairman of the board of Warder Rand, Incorporated. He died in 1951. There was no photograph of Ronald Rizom Haran. The only news item concerning Haran reported an attempted burglary of the Haran Gallery in 1975. From the way the item was written, Fletch guessed it had been taken straight from a police spokesperson. There was no actual confirmation. There was no follow-up story. The obituary of Grace Galkis Haran preceded her husband's folder in the file. A graduate of Wellesley College and heiress to the Galkis fortune, Galkis rubber, she was mostly noted for being owner of the Star of Hunan Jade. She was a victim of leukemia. There were perhaps 45 clippings under Francis Xavier Flynn's name, all dating within the last 18 months. Fletch did not read through all the reports, but he noticed they followed a pattern. A crime would be reported. A follow-up story would report Flynn had been assigned to it. After a few days of absolutely static news stories in which there would be no new news, there would be the public outcry story. Why has this crime not been solved? Impatient city editors who believed they were getting a runaround from the police were quick to report to the public its indignation. Immediately thereafter, a police spokesperson would announce an imminent arrest. Not immediately thereafter. Flynn would be quoted in response to questioning as saying, "Nonsense, we're not arresting anybody." At first, this announcement would be followed by another public outcry story, or one which regretfully questioned the competence of the Boston police. Not in response, absolutely on his own time schedule, Flynn would announce an arrest. Frequently, the arrest report appeared as a small item on a back page. Halfway through the file, references began to appear to Inspector Francis Reluctant Flynn. The public outcry and police incompetence stories became less frequent, and then stopped altogether. The press had discovered they couldn't push Flynn. They had also discovered he was pretty good. One of the earliest reports referred to Flynn as formerly Chicago Precinct Chief of Detectives. "Do you need anything, Mr. Locke?" The young hypocrite ambled up the row between the file cabinets. "No thanks, Randy." Fletch shut the drawer. "I guess I'm done." "What's the story you're working on, Mr. Locke?" "Nothing very interesting. Feature on the history of New England celebrations of the American Revolution." "Oh." The kid appeared to agree it wasn't very interesting. If Ralph Locke was working on such a nothing story, he wasn't very interesting either. "I expect you'll read it," Fletch said. "It will be under my byline." Chapter 18. Fletch found Jack Saunders in the city room. Someone had handed him a wire photo, which he showed to Fletch. It was a picture of the President of the United States trying to put on a sweater without first removing his visorized cap and sunglasses. "That's news, huh?" "Actually, it is," said Fletch. "I always thought he stepped into his sweaters." Jack dropped the picture on the copy desk. "Send it over to the Sunday feature section. Maybe they'll run it under trends." "Jack, I'd like to see your art critic."
"So would I," said Jack. "I'm not sure I ever have. We get a lot of phone calls for him, mostly angry. His name's Charles Wainwright."
They walked down a long, dark corridor to the back of the building. Fletch said, "Do you remember Inspector Flynn in Chicago?"
"What, Flynn? Reluctant Flynn?"
"Yeah. Your copy said he was a precinct chief of detectives in Chicago before coming here."
"The Star said that?"
"Your very own newspaper."
"Frank Flynn was never in Chicago. Not 2 years ago, and not with that rank. I would have had to know him."
"I don't remember him either."
"That's a mystery," said Jack.
"That's a mystery."
Charles Wainwright was the filthiest man Fletch had ever seen indoors. His face was only relatively shaved, as if beard had been pulled out in tufts. In his 50s, particularly his nose and chin, gave sustenance to many black-headed pimples. His shirt collars were turning up in decay. And on the shirt front, where the protruding stomach had stopped their fall, were evidences of at least a dozen meals. Tomato sauce had dribbled into egg yolk.
"This is our great art critic, Charles Wainwright. Ralph," Jack said. "Charles, Ralph Locke is in from Chicago, here working on a story."
Fletch braced himself to shake hands, but the slob didn't require it.
"Do what you can for him, huh?"
"Why should I?"
It took Jack a second to realize the question was serious.
"Because I asked you to."
"I don't see why I should do this man's work for him. I have work of my own to do."
Fletch said, "Actually, I'm not working on a story, Mr. Wainwright. There's a rumor around Chicago that one of your Boston dealers might donate a painting to the museum there, and the publisher just asked me to stop by and have you fill me in on him."
"What do you mean? You want me to do a story on him?"
"If the guy actually donates the painting, I'd think you'd be the first person we'd call."
"Who is it?"
"Horan."
"Ronnie?
Is that what he's called?" Not concealing his disgust, Jack said to Fletch, "Good luck," and left. In the small office, newspapers and books were piled everywhere, other newspapers and books thrown on top of them. And on top of that was mildew and then dust. Wainwright sat at his desk. He rather sank among the piles.
"I've known Ronnie for years."
There was no other place in the room to sit. Although apparently permanent, none of the piles looked stable enough to bear weight. Wainwright said,
"We went to Yale together."
"Hygiene department?"
"I guess he could give a painting to Chicago if he wanted to. I can't think why I'd want to."
"Ah, the old city still turns a few people on. Rare beef and frequent wind, you know. Gets the blood up."
"Maybe Grace had some connection with Chicago. Maybe that's it. Her family was in the rubber business. Grace Galkus, Galkus Rubber."
"Not following you."
"Ronnie married Grace after the war, when he was back taking his doctorate at Harvard."
"And she's rich?"
"Was rich. She died after they'd been married a few years. One of those terrible diseases, cancer, leukemia, something. Ronnie was heartbroken."
"And rich."
I suppose he inherited. He started the gallery back about that time, and you don't start a gallery like that off the pay of a Harvard instructor.
He never married again?
No, I've seen him with a lot of women over the years, but he never remarried. Ever hear of the Star of Hunan Jade?
What is it?
It's a big rock, a famous jewel. Grace used to own it. I'm just wondering now what became of it. I must ask Ronnie.
You'll ask him what he did with his wife's jewels?
There's no such thing as an improper question, just an improper answer.
So Horan has plenty of money?
I don't know. I don't know how much he inherited from Grace, how much went back into her family coffers. These are things you don't know about people, especially in Boston. You know what's happened to money since the 1950s.
Heard rumors.
He lives well in that castle on Newbury Street where he has his gallery. The top two floors are his penthouse apartment. He drives a Rolls Royce, and anyone who drives a Rolls Royce must be broke.
Doesn't he have another house somewhere?
Maybe, I don't know.
I mean, he can't just live over the shop.
I've never heard he has another place.
Was he in the service?
Yes, Navy, Pacific Theater during World War II. He was an aide to Admiral Kimberly.
That was before he married Lagalkas?
Yeah.
So, how did he have enough political muscle to land a cushy admiral's aide job?
Well, Wainwright said, he went to Yale. A very smooth, attractive guy, very polished.
Where's he from, originally?
Some place up country, Maine or Vermont, I forget. There's no money there. He was broke at Yale.
I see.
He still teaches at Harvard, some kind of a freshman art survey course. He's written a couple of turgid books.
Turgid?
Academic. I was never able to get through them. You know, the kind of book where the author spends 150,000 words correcting the opinion of someone else who didn't matter anyway.
Turgid.
Your name is Ralph Locke?
Yeah.
What paper?
Chicago Post.
You write on art?
Oh, no, said Fletch. I'm a sports writer. Hockey.
Vulgar.
Rough.
Primitive.
Simple.
Violent.
I take it you like writing on the arts.
Fletch looked around the room.
You must have a great visual sense.
The filthy man sitting in the filthy room neither confirmed nor denied the assertion.
Fletch said, tell me more about the Horan Gallery. Is it doing well?
Who knows? As an art dealer, Ronnie's the creme de la creme. Horan is not a walk-in gallery. He's an international art dealer making deals that are so private even the parties involved aren't sure what they're doing. He has to play very close to the chest. He could have made millions. He could be stone broke, for all I know.
Which do you think?
Well, the art market in recent years has had extraordinary ups and downs. First, the Japanese came along and invested heavily. Then some of them had to dump on the market. Then Arabs came along trying to bury petrodollars. Many Japanese weren't deeply schooled in Western art. And Islam has a distinct prejudice against representations of the human or animate figure. So there have been some funny, unpredictable distortions in the market. Plus, of course, the art market reflects every distortion in the nature of money itself. Some people have made killings off the market. Others have gotten badly stuck.
And you don't know which has been Horan's experience.
No, but I'm interested to hear he might give a painting to Chicago. I might use the item in my column.
By all means do, said Fletch. I'm very grateful to you for all your help. Chapter 19. Fletch led the plainclothesman through Friday evening commuter traffic back to his apartment house.